This podcast is brought to you by Aviation Safety Magazine, the monthly journal of risk management and accident prevention.
Hello, you're listening to Glenn Pugh for AvWeb.com. Peter Burkill had been captain of British Airways Flight 38, a Boeing 777 that in 2008 crashed short of the runway at Heathrow. But when the jet stopped and everyone got out alive, the drama for then-Captain Burkill was, in many ways, just beginning. In today's podcast, Peter's here to tell the story of what happened next. Peter, thank you for joining us again.
Hello, Glenn. It's a pleasure.
In our last podcast, you shared your experience of the crash. I'll ask you to again set the stage for us, this time after the crash. What were those first few days like for you?
Yeah, well, straight after the crash, I think I left you pretty much at the bottom of the slide. So the first thing that happens after a big event like that is that you get surrounded by people who need to talk to you. And after you get over the initial interest from the local police and the bystanders, you get the police come along pretty quickly, in my case, and they started to do their interview with me. And a few breathalyzers as well to check for alcohol. And then very quickly the air accident investigators turn up and they then want to have their piece of you. My interview with them took about 2.5 or 3 hours, something like that. And you have to relive every single minute and second, in my case, of the whole flight, starting from leaving the crew hotel. In fact, even the whole slip before, the night stops before. So it takes a very long time to analyse everything. And then, of course, when you get down to the final event, it actually becomes quite emotional because it's only happened 3 or 4 hours previous. And then that follows by sort of internal interviews from British Airways. They need to know what's happened for their own safety audits as well. And all that takes, you know, a few hours, a quick visit to the doctor as well. And that's basically the first afternoon that happened to me. And then a quick meal, a couple of beverages with some of the union reps that evening, and to unwind and basically get the adrenaline out of the system, because it stays in there for hours. I think mine dissipated, some 17 hours after the event, it stayed in the system. So finally able to go to sleep. And the next day, I woke up in sort of mild disbelief, really, that this big event could have happened to me the day before. I didn't quite believe it until I switched on the television in my hotel room and the phone started ringing. Journalists had managed to find out where I was staying. But I just couldn't believe that it happened. So I wanted to go and visit the scene of the crash and see the aeroplane with my own eyes, just so I could take it in. So I did that in the morning, and I walked around with the CEO, Willie Walsh, of British Airways. I remember apologising to him for breaking one of his expensive aeroplanes. He said, "Don't worry about it. It's a good crash for British Airways. This is fine." And then he asked me if I wanted to go on a live press conference that afternoon. He said it would be good for British Airways. And, of course, if your CEO says it's good for British Airways and your company, you're a loyal employee, then you're going to accept that offer. So I found myself talking to the worldwide media that Friday afternoon. It's about after 24 hours, basically after the crash. That was my first time doing a live press conference, and that's probably more nerve-wracking than the actual accident, to be honest. So I was pleased when that was over. And then finally, I could look forward to going seeing my wife and kids. So I finally got to see them. It's about 30 hours after the crash. It was great for me when I finally caught up with them and managed to see them after such a traumatic event. But then we were hidden away then. You know, we weren't in our house and we were down in a strange hotel apartment. I wasn't allowed to speak to the press at all. I was gagged basically by my employer. And because we were hidden away, and you know, I had to close the curtains at this hotel room after a while because the press had found us after a day, and they wanted photos. So the speculation started at that stage, even after a day or two after the crash. Why was the captain hiding away? They weren't being told anything. But personally, for me, it was obviously great to be with my family. I could put aside the press, although that was annoying me already. You know, it's fantastic to be alive, and you know, it's very emotional for me as well, because I could imagine my boys and my wife being there without me, and that was rather upsetting, because I, of course, nearly couldn't be with them.
Your days must have been very busy. Was there ever any mental escape from any of this?
Not really. I was imagining things going on during the day, you know, the what-if scenarios. I think it's quite natural. You try and imagine what would have happened if the engines had stopped 3 minutes earlier, 2 minutes earlier, if the engines had stopped whilst we were in the hold over Lambourne. You know, we'd have just about made the airfield. Where would we have gone? You know, if we'd been over the city and the engines had failed, we wouldn't have been able to make anywhere near the runway and the safety of the grass. And the Thames is a nice little highway, stands out, but it's a very small river in between the buildings of London. So it's not an obvious place. There wouldn't have been room to put a 777 down on it. There's a few parks around, but, you know, they're very wooded. And, yeah, there was very little place to go. So I was imagining all the what-ifs for a couple of days, and I could never find a better solution. I could never find a better place for the accident to have happened. It's quite strange, really. And then at night, when I was asleep, when I finally was able to get to sleep, I'd start dreaming, and I was having some nasty dreams. Not about the actual accident, but related dreams, I think, to the accident, about Troy Miller's son falling down a hole, and I'd have to dive down after him to save him. But I, first couple of times I dreamt it, I didn't save him, and eventually I managed to catch up with him, and we'd fall and hit the ground together. So I wasn't really able to escape it, no.
Now, all of that seems to me to fall into sort of the post-traumatic stress category. I understand that British Airways sent you all to counseling. Is that right? What was that experience like?
Yeah, the cabin crew was sent off to different councils, I understand. But John Coward, my first officer, who was flying the aircraft, him and I went to the same psychologist to be analysed for post-traumatic stress disorder and check if we're okay. So we went on two different occasions, both together, and talked about events, not totally in line with the crash, but yeah, just surrounding it. And I found it a very interesting couple of sessions, really. I learned a lot about the brain and neurology. I found it very interesting. I didn't quite feel I was being analysed, but then I suppose that's the whole point of a psychologist. You don't actually feel that you're being checked. So that was done within the first 3 weeks, I think, and he gave John and I the all clear after about 3 weeks, and said, yeah, you're fine. You can go back to flying in about 10 days, you know, give your body time to get adjusted to the fact that you're actually going to go back into a flight deck.
Well, now, meanwhile, the investigators are starting up their work. This crash was unique in that they had very early on, they had both the cockpit voice and the flight data recorders, but neither of them were really providing them with any ready answers. How did that affect you?
I first heard the cockpit voice recorder about 5 or 6 days after the crash, I think. All the flight deck went into the AIB to listen to it at the same time. And first of all, I was surprised by the length of the tape. Obviously, the few minutes were the most important. But the actual crash time was so short, and I was so shocked by it. I couldn't believe that it was these 43 seconds of time when it all happened. And then it was a very quiet tape, and I knew it was quiet. I knew nothing was said much in the flight deck. But so there's the quiet period from the time where John points out the fact that it looks like a double engine failure to me talking about airspeed low, and then my mayday call, and there is nothing in between, because we're both very busy in the flight deck doing our own things, and there's no time for me to communicate with John. So yeah, the CVR was not giving anything other than we had informed the investigators already. And the digital flight data recorder wasn't giving them much information either. And then there was a problem with the quick access recorder that had lost its short-term memory information that it stores for about 45 seconds. Fortunately, it was just about to download that information when the crash happened, and they lost that information. They couldn't retrieve it. And I think that would have been the important analysis they needed to enable a much quicker investigation and result. So it was disappointing that there was no evidence found straight away. And I think because of that, it led to a much longer conclusion to the investigation.
The fact that you didn't have information coming back to you that answered these questions, how did that affect you? I mean, you must have been hoping that someone would be able to tell you why your engines failed, and you didn't have that.
Yeah, naturally, I was extremely interested why these engines had given us this problem. I knew it wasn't something that we'd done in the flight. I knew that. I knew that as soon as we crashed, and in fact, before we left the flight deck, I turned around to the other two before we'd even got out of the flight deck, and I said, you know, I had a quick look at the fuel gauges, because I always felt it was a fuel problem, and I could see the left wing still had 5 tons in it, the center tank had nothing, and the right wing was not showing a display, that had broken. So I knew we had at least 5 tons in, and it was balanced, so yeah, it was the 10 tons I was expecting. So I knew it wasn't a catastrophic loss of fuel. But I turned around and I said, look, guys, this isn't our problem. But I wanted to know what was the problem. Of course I did. I was a pilot, and I'd had one of the, a crash that was unprecedented, and on one of the best aircraft in the world, one of the most modern aircraft in the world, and yet why was it fail? Why did it give me this problem?
And carrying that with you, what happened when you went back to work?
Yeah, when I went back to work, my first flight was after about a month, and I was doing a London Gatwick to Houston in Texas, and I was excited to be back in the flight deck. You know, every pilot wants to get back in the saddle and get airborne again, and I was just the same. John was just the same too. And halfway across the Atlantic, I went out for a little stretch of the legs, and I was chatting to some of the cabin crew, and two of them had just done their annual safety equipment training, and they'd been told during that training that I, as the captain of the BA-38, hadn't done anything during the last stage of the flight. In fact, I'd frozen. I was that frightened by the whole situation, I'd actually frozen, and I hadn't even initiated a mayday call, and I hadn't initiated the evacuation.
The crew was saying this about you?
And they were saying it directly to my face, and I was standing there pretty much gobsmacked in total disbelief. You know, a captain who had so much confidence what he could do, suddenly being told that actually he was rubbish. And I thought, hang on a minute, where's this come from? And they said, well, we've been told it by the trainers at British Airways. And I went, well, do you want me to tell you what actually happened? They went, no, it's okay. You know, we can see it's upsetting you now. Oh, yeah, we know you froze. You know, it must have been horrible. It must have been terrifying. And I said, no, it wasn't, actually. It wasn't terrifying. I'm going to tell you what actually happened, because I was there and your trainers weren't. So please listen to me and take on board, please. And they went, no, it's okay. We can see it's upsetting you. I was like, no, you're going to listen now, because this is serious. So I told them, and I could see that they wanted to believe me, but I could also see that they were concerned if it was the truth or not, because they'd been told by their trainers. So who do they believe? So that was the first inkling I got of my future troubles, really, because that obviously led me to having a meeting with my managers. I was very, very angry about what I'd heard on that flight, and I had a meeting with my managers, you know, asking them to stop this gossip spreading around the training camp, and you know, that was spreading like wildfire through every flight and throughout the whole airline. And in my mind, you know, everybody, all the cabin crew were now going to be thinking this. So I needed it stopped ASAP. And I was told that, don't worry, you know, the British Airways internal safety report will be out in a couple of weeks, and that will tell everybody in the airline what your actions were, and that, you know, that will vindicate your actions. So I said, okay, that's fine. So I stayed at home for a couple of weeks whilst this report was finalised, and unfortunately it didn't materialise in 2 weeks. In fact, it didn't materialise in 3 weeks. And the 3 weeks went into 4 weeks. That month became 2 months, became 3 months. And so after 3 months of sat at home, not flying, on a reduced pay because I wasn't flying, I was, you know, A, starting to get short of money, and B, I knew that people were starting to question why I was sat at home. Why wasn't this captain flying who'd had this crash? Had he done something seriously wrong? And so the speculation started again. And I started to hear that cabin crew were now frightened to fly with me because I'd frozen, because I wasn't good in an emergency. And it was just being fueled. These rumours were being fueled by me sat at home again because I was waiting for this report to come out. So finally, when I went back to full-time flying again in May 08, so about 4 months after the crash, I then thought it would be okay because this report had come out, although it hadn't been released to the general employees in British Airways. They themselves were concerned about it being leaked to the media. So they only released the report to director level and above, which basically means that the general flying community wouldn't be able to read it. So it didn't really help the cause for me at all. And I still went to work. I found that I was still having to defend myself to mainly to cabin crew. The pilots were totally understandable and they're very interested in hearing the whole story. But I found myself having to defend myself with some cabin crew members who were constantly questioning my actions and if I actually did something. So it was a very unpleasant next 6 months, really.
Now, somewhere in here, Chesley Sullenberger's crash in the Hudson took place. It was similar, somewhat, in that they'd lost both engines, but Chesley was almost immediately proclaimed a hero. How did you feel about that crash and the aftermath that played out there?
Yeah, it's you know, well done, Captain Sullenberger. Fantastic. If I take you back about 2 months before his crash, I think it might make the story a little bit more impelling, because in November of 08, I received a safety award for excellence for my incident from the One World Cockpit Crew Coalition. And it was presented to me by the chairman of the American Airlines Pilot Association. And he asked me during that meeting, he said, "Now, you know, how's your year been so far? It must have been fantastic." And I said, "Do you really want me to explain to you what's gone on?" He went, "Oh, yeah, it must have been great." And I said, "No, it's been terrible." You know, and I explained to him what had happened and how it's been bad for the whole family, really. You know, how we're now short of money because I hadn't been to work. The rooms going around were terrible. And he listened for, nearly an hour to both my wife and I. And he said, "That is terrible." And I said, "I'm only telling you this because I would hate to see it happen to an American pilot. If he had a crash in the States, I would not want him to go through the year that me and my family have just gone through." And he told me, he said, "Peter, don't worry. In the States, we have the protocol set down, all set out, and it would look after any pilot that suffered from your accident or a similar one. He would be looked after straight away." So when Captain Sullenberger had his incident in the Hudson, I was sat at home watching the news, and it was exactly 52 weeks to the day, would you believe, since the BA-38. So it was a Thursday as well. So it was 52 weeks to the day, which made it all the more bizarre to me as I watched his accident unfold, because it was like a parallel. And I could see it, with similarities, but very different. Mm-hmm. I was so pleased for him because not only for his successful outcome, but also because I knew his year would be far better than ours. And I was just so pleased for him.
Well, in the end, it took the AAIB, the Air Accidents and Investigation Branch, no less than 2 years to release its final report on your accident. It's roughly 180 pages long. It's got 11 appendices. You had 30 seconds to physically deal with the content that that report aims to resolve, and 2 years to think about how you'd done it. How did you feel when the AAIB's final report came out?
Well, of course, I knew, you know, all along, you know, for 2 years, what should be written about the pilot side of the actions. But I wanted to know the nitty-gritty of what had gone wrong with the engines. But when the report finally came out, it was good to know that it was out and that the public would be able to read it, and it would tell them what I'd done, basically, because that was the problem I was having with the general perception that everyone's having about me. So it was 2 years, and surely nobody would be interested in the situation anymore. You know, most people had already formulated in their minds what had happened, and they weren't really bothered about it anymore. So it felt a bit late for me. But then again, it wasn't too late for me, because it helps to finalize the event on a personal level.
Going back over the report yourself and going back over the actions you'd taken in the actual flight, if you'd had taken control from John, had taken manual control, what do you think the outcome would have been? How do you think you might have been perceived in that case?
I was chatting to the investigator of my accident after the final report had been released, and on a personal level, I was able to talk to him quite in depth about some of the issues. And at the end of it, he said, "Pete, if you'd have taken control at 400 feet or below, then it would have been a very different outcome, and it would have been the wrong thing to do. And I'd have had to slate you for it in the final report if you'd done that, because you couldn't have managed the situation." And I'd agreed with him totally. In my mind, if I'd taken control from John at that stage of the flight, because I just wanted to be, you know, the big captain who lands the plane, that's what I have to do, I wouldn't have had the capacity. I don't think I'd have had the capacity to think about changing the flaps. I really don't. And John, being a first officer, I don't think would have thought about it. If he had thought about it, he wouldn't have been able to change them without getting the say and the nod from me as the captain. It was such a big decision. It was only a captain's decision to change the flap at that stage. So I believe, it would have been a very different outcome. We would have smashed into the either the fence or the ILS antenna, and the damage would have been far worse. Probably ended up in a serious fire, and at least one person would have died, and probably dozens more.
Well, ultimately, it seemed to me you did have vindication in the report itself. The investigation pointed to ice in the fuel as a cause. John had kept the plane flying and level at impact, and your flap selection had won you 50 meters, clearing every obstacle.
Mm-hmm.
Was that vindication to you at all? Or was it too late, as you'd said?
It was a little late for me. I felt the distance was further than that. It felt further. My initial view of the impact point was buildings at Hatton Cross, and the fact that we made it over the ILS antenna was a lot further than 50 meters. But that was what was found, so I can't disagree with that. But it was still an improvement. But for me, it was hidden in the middle of the report, and I'm a bit disappointed that you have to really hunt for it. But then the report wasn't about me or the pilot's actions, because we were never under analysis, so I shouldn't be bothered about it. But emotionally, yes, I am, because I've been trying to fight my corner for 2 years about what I did, and I'm having to fight when I was at work, I was having to defend myself. So yes, for me, it wasn't quite vindication enough, but yes, it's there in black and white. If you need to hunt for it.
And how do you feel now that the report is out, about the past 2 years? And what does the future hold for you? I know you're no longer with British Airways.
No, I left I left British Airways. That decision was fairly long in the making, but basically because I felt unable to continue working for them, I needed to try and escape, really, and go somewhere else. But with the knowledge that other airlines were due to recruit, and I had pretty much a promissory note that I would get a job with one in particular in the Middle East, it seemed like the right decision. But, yeah, certainly the last 2 years since the crash, it's totally changed our lives. I mean, totally. There's so many personal issues that got on, and I'm sorry to plug it, but our book goes into that in greater depth. But basically, I've had so many emails, especially over the last couple of weeks, from strangers and old friends, full of praise and mainly support for me to stay positive and look ahead. But very recently, I've been talking to someone in very high places with high powers, and something interesting might be coming of this in the future. And I just think what would be great to get from this accident is something that helps some people in the future. Some good has got to come from every crash. At least nobody dies in either my crash or Captain Sullenberger's crash. But we always learn from accidents, and that's the important thing. And I just hope that this person in higher powers can get something good for the future in aviation. I think it will. I think that's what's going to come from this.
Peter, thank you sincerely for your time. This has been Glenn Pugh speaking with Peter Burkill, captain of British Airways Flight 38. The book he mentioned that details his experience is called 30 Seconds to Impact. It's available at peterburkill.com and should be on amazon.com shortly. For avweb.com, thanks for listening.
This podcast has been brought to you by Aviation Safety Magazine. For more on aviation safety, log on to www.aviationsafetymagazine.com.